If you don't put yourself out there in something that you don't know and you're not experienced in, then no one can criticize you for failing because you never tried it.
Yeah.
You know, some people are just a little bit more prudent in life and they'd rather go through life not having this big failure in their eyes than see that, you know, with that risk comes a massive opportunity that if they succeed, they can elevate their lives. And some people see that and some people don't. And it's really, really rewarding when you find the people that do.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Fresh Perspective, where we take another look at life. My guest today is Justin Willard. Justin, thank you very much for joining me.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We look forward to the amazing insights and perspective that you'll bring. Life-changing, I've heard, is the stuff that you share. So my very first question, Justin, is a very simple one that I ask everyone. Is what do you do? What do you do for a living?
All right. So I'm in automotive retail. So we own 15 car dealerships across the country. Mainly Western Cape, Gauteng, with some along the coast up to Eastern Cape. And we focus predominantly in the non-luxury brand. So below luxury, let's call it mid-tier, Nissan, Renault, Mitsubishi. And then we've got other brands like Mahindra and Chery now. Chery is a new brand that's come to our stable from China. We're a private company operating 15 dealerships across a few provinces and all the new, used, and the workshop and parts that go with it.
Wow. Okay. And what's your role within that?
So I'm a CA by qualification, and obviously my title is CFO, which was probably very true up until about 4 or 5 years ago. But now I've got kind of a dual role. I'm CFO / COO. So I report directly to the CEO. Marcel is more into the strategic side of the business and looking for strategic growth, et cetera, and managing relationships with the OEMs and banks. And then my role is actually more operations now. I don't really look at the finances as much. I've got two FMs that manage that and I just look at the big picture, but obviously if stuff goes wrong, I'm ultimately responsible for it. So I've got like a foot in both camps, even though I'd like to get completely out of the finance side of things.
Okay. So that's actually something you are working towards, moving out of that completely, or do you just mean in terms of this company?
Correct. Yeah, no, I think the degree was a means to an end. It was something that I just thought was a good building base for life. It wasn't something that completely resonated with me. And I don't think I was quite the odd one out in terms of the article clerks and in auditing. It wasn't something that I enjoyed tremendously. it was a good base. It set me up for a decent, you know, first job, and things grew from there. But the operations is what actually excites me, the people, building relationships with people, seeing people come up the ranks in terms of our dealerships, you know, and building that belief in themselves that you can see, you know, we've had cleaners start that then we encourage and they get their driver's license and then they become drivers. And then before you know it, they're part salesmen. And you know, so they're working their way up and building a life for themselves and supporting their families and that side of things, trying to help that light bulb go off in the staff member's head that it's possible is what makes me tick. So that's way more exciting than looking at an Excel spreadsheet. So.
I know many, many CAs that kind of at some stage feel like, okay, no, I can't do this for the rest of my life, and then transition. And some of them, clients of mine, that's like, I want to, but I'm scared. So what helped you just take that leap and leave a job, which I'm assuming has a lot of had a lot of job security for you as well, and move into this space?
So I think I was lucky. It was a long transition. And at the time, our executive structure was lean. It was myself as FD / CFO and Marcel, who was MD, and obviously then more of operational. And because of our operations across provinces, I said to him, okay, well, I want to learn operations. You don't want to go to Joburg anymore. This was before I had family. Let me go. I'll travel to Joburg. It's not the most incredible place to visit, but there's something palpable about the energy in Joburg. I think some of our business owners here in Cape Town could take lessons from the waiters in Joburg. There's a hunger and there's a drive, and that excited me. So he stepped back from going to Joburg. I had initially just the Joburg operations. At that time, we owned a Hyundai dealership in Midrand. And I said, let this be my baby. I'll take care of this. I'll drive sales. I'll drive people. And this can be my pilot. And I excelled at it and it worked well. And Marcel was happy because he didn't have to travel to Joburg as much. And I was getting the operational experience while still being a CFO. I think it just kind of progressed over time. And now we've expanded quite rapidly in the last year with probably four or five new operations. So, and then I started feeling the crunch because my FM couldn't handle the workload. So I was getting pulled more into that, but I didn't have the capacity to do it. So we hired a new FM or a second FM about 6 months ago. And so far that's going very well.
Okay. So did you experience any kind of fear in that transition, or is the fact that it was so gradual, you didn't have to break through any kind of fear barriers?
I think I was more excited. Excited to get out of the finance thing and have a new, a new project and a new goal to work towards. And it was liberating. So for me, it was more excitement than fear. I'm quite a positive person, so I'll always see glass half full. I think I saw more of the opportunity that I could do rather than the risk of failure there.
Okay. Now I want to know about the things that you see within staff members, and that you said that light bulb moment for them, where they realize, oh, wait a minute, these are my words. There's more for me. I can do more. How do you help people get there? And what do you see stops them the most?
Francois, sure. That's a tough question. Mm. I think there needs to be this, in some people, there's an inherent belief of, prudency or failure, that there is no way. I don't think with as much coaching as you want to give, maybe you disagree with this, it's your profession. But from my perspective, not being a professional in that sphere, you can invest a lot of time and you're not changing that individual's mindset. Then there are others where just after a little bit of working together and showing encouragement and support, that's the main thing. If you support them in a way that they feel that they can fail, but fail forwards, right? And they have the liberty to fail if they're at least putting in the effort to try fail forwards, then it gives them the environment to grow. And I think you can see very early on whether someone has a growth mindset or not. And the people that are willing to put in the work and show small amounts of growth in the beginning, then encourage you as, let's call it, a mentor. Because I think that's a very different role to the boss, right? Now you're taking a step out of the boss role and you're trying to be a mentor because you're trying to show this person that they can jump to the next level in their life. I think if you've given them the right space to try and not and realize that even if they fail initially, that there's room for growth, and they start showing interest and gravitate towards that process, then it's a lot easier for you then to commit more time to that process. Mm. And realize you're not and not worry that you're wasting your time in someone that's not going to do anything with it anyway.
That's a good answer. So definitely I can understand what you mean, that sometimes there's so many things that keep people stuck and trapped in a certain mindset. And yeah, sure, maybe I've got as a coach more tools to try and help people out of that, but sometimes people just aren't ready or willing, and they are more comfortable, you know, remaining a victim and holding on to the things that they say, this is why I cannot move forward or cannot achieve, because going out there is scary. Risking and taking responsibility is scary, because then if you fail, it's on you. Then you have to take responsibility. So, okay, you agree with that kind of viewpoint that's what happens, you know?
If you don't... Because
tell me more about that reward for you. What do you get out of that?
So obviously private company, family run business. It is quite a close business overall, even though we are in different provinces, etc. Each dealership is it's very close. The staff work well together for the most part. And you can see the impact that, you know, staff members have, the growth have on them and then their families. You know, like you'll check in and you'll see families at year-end functions, and you'll see the family growing because of the individual that's working for you growing and being able to support their family better than they did last year and the year before. And I think, you know, we work in an environment with quite a high staff turnover. Just naturally, there's just no two ways about it. I think a lot, generally speaking, a lot of sales execs are quite myopic, and they'll jump from job to job for a couple grand extra increase, but not see, you know, like they've actually put in 3 years of work with their database that are know them as this guy from this dealership. Mm-hmm. So inherently we have a high staff turnover in our industry. So it's even more rewarding when we have, I mean, in some of our dealerships, we've got sales guys that have been with us for 15 years, which is remarkable. So that to me is testimony to us cultivating relationships long-term, that they feel comfortable that they're in an environment that they are protected and nurtured and rewarded when they are performing, that they don't feel the need to jump ship. And we do have a lot of turnover anyway, but the good guys, the quality guys will stay. So, you know, for me, just that speaks that we're doing something right, that we're encouraging this kind of environment where they can grow, and the impact that that shows on their families, especially to me, is rewarding. And I don't know how to put it into words. It's a special thing to see year on year.
Now you've touched on many topics that I also want to discuss with you. Let's start with the growth mindset. I'm assuming you are referring to Carol Dweck's book Mindset.
Yes.
Okay. How did you come about learning about growth mindset, and how do you apply it in your own life?
Yeah. So I've I actually haven't finished that book. I started it and I got distracted, but I understand the principle but and I just know it's very, for me, it's very frustrating when people have this limiting mindset, right? And they feel like there's no options of growth, etc. I am maybe too impatient. Maybe that's one of my probably weaker character flaws, is I can probably discern very quickly if someone has a mindset that they want to work and grow, or they got quite a defeatist attitude and mindset. And I can cut off those kind of people quickly. Maybe it's a self-preservation. I don't want to waste time and effort in people that can't grow and change their environment and the way that they, where they're sitting in their life at the moment. But conversely, I really admire, it doesn't matter what your status in life is, if you have the ability to see yourself now and see yourself where you want to be in 5 years' time, then I dive into that and I harness that. And I love to spend time with people like that. It doesn't matter. You know, as I said, I mean, I've had a driver say to me, he wants to be the top salesman in 5-10 years' time. And at the time, it seems like quite an audacious statement, but then 5-10 years later, they're at a level where they've proved that they believed that, you mm-hmm. know, in the past. And that's why they're there now. And it's incredible. They've like 10x'd what they were earning 5 years ago. You know, it's just something you can't actually explain. So yeah, I don't know if I've, again, I don't know if I've answered your question.
Yes, you did. You did, definitely. I want to talk about the stigma a little bit, because in my industry as well, you know, people see life coaching as therapy, and therapy especially has a stigma around, okay, well, there's something wrong with you. It's shameful to have to see someone or get help or get input. Whereas, you know, people don't view getting a sport coach in the same way or a personal trainer in the same way. What are the stigmas around your industry? I know there are some, but how do you phrase them? And do you have a plan to kind of counter that? And what are the best jokes about car salesmen that you know?
I don't know any jokes. I just know we all painted with this used car salesman stigma, which is understandable. I mean, we've all had a bad experience with one of these little small town used car lots. It's not a proper business. You know, it's someone that's bought a couple of cars, made some money, bought a few more cars, and they've suddenly got like 20, 30 cars on their stand. There's no franchise agreements with proper businesses like your manufacturers that we have to go through. There's no collateral.
Can you say more about that, please, Justin? Because I mean, I don't know the industry, and maybe this will shed some light for many people on exactly why work with a company like yours versus something else. What's the pros and cons?
Yeah, so I mean, whether you're buying a new car or a used car from us, we sign a dealer agreement with each of the manufacturers. Let's say Nissan or Renault or whatever. We've got one with each of the manufacturers. And there are strict requirements that we have to stick to. And it's all about, we send financials to them on a monthly basis. They have inspections on our premises on a monthly basis. The banks, we've got dealer agreements with the banks, obviously, and collateral with those loans, because our cars are on loans from the bank. So there's a lot more protection for the end user when it comes to buying from a dealership that is actually a franchise dealership. I can't really comment for those, you know, Lansdowne, Goodwood used car operations, but I would feel like there's a lot more risk if you've got comebacks, et cetera, on a used car with them honoring their deal. Whereas us, we've got a lot more to lose. You know, it's not just this one used car that we've sold you. You're going to comment on our Facebook group or Google page or whatever, and we've got a whole brand to protect besides the used car operation. Wow. So yeah, that's the one side. Obviously, I understand where people are coming from. There've been so many shady used car dealers in the past. It is an industry that is notoriously bad for that. The way that we are trying to remedy that in our own business, and I think you can, it's going to be, this is not going to be a 2 year, 5 year correction. This almost needs to be like a 10, 20 year correction. Mm. And hopefully we can lead the way. But our weekly meetings, we reiterate time and time and time and time again, until it sounds like I'm a stuck record, that besides your house, your second biggest purchase in your life is your car, right? And the car sales guys that are operating well and selling a lot of cars earn very well. There are some just sales execs that earn better than a CA when they come out of articles. It is just what it is. So I try to emphasize that it's a professional job. You're a professional here. You're dealing with one of the biggest purchases that this customer is going to do. And I know this might be your 10th sale for this month. It might be your 100th sale for this year, but this is the first time or the second time that this person's buying a car. Mm. So treat it like that, right? So if you make this a special occasion for that person, that they walk off that dealership floor and say, that was incredible, then you've got a customer for life. You know, I think the opportunity here is that the vehicle sales market in general is poor. So you don't have to be shooting the lights out to be in the top 1%. You just have to be, you know, better than the rest. And these little things add up. They seem silly, and these guys, half of them don't buy into it, and some of them do. And the guys that do, you can see. And these customers, they don't even have to contact the customer. The customer comes back a couple of years, they send their friends, you know. So that's free sales. You know, you're not paying for advertising to get that word of mouth customer. And it's a solid lead that comes because you treated this customer as if this was the only deal you're delivering this month. That's what I say. Treat it as if it's the only deal you're delivering this month. You'll put the effort and love into the delivery, and that will be palpable, and you'll gain a customer for life. Mm. So I think, you know, little things like that, it's a very tricky thing. I think we're also looking for graduates, but, you know, the graduates are generally quite wet behind the ears in terms of sales. They don't have that same like killer sales side. So do you start investing in graduates that are a little bit more expensive straight off the bat and take time to train them in the sales arena? Or do we, try harder and harder to get your sales guys who are prolific salesmen to start thinking a little bit, you know, long-term? This is not a one deal today. This is a relationship that you can build over 5 years and then get a repeat customer two or three times.
I love that. I love the fact that you view it as a something that someone does, like, you know, maybe once in 3 to 5 years or whatever, and making it special. I've had experience like that. Also, I've had the experience on the other side. And I mean, it's such a massive gap. Huge gap. And obviously you immediately want to send your friends, if you are looking for a car, talk to this guy.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So for me, it's really is as simple as make the delivery special. And as that customer walks off the floor, you've got their ID number through the deal. You had to get that. So put the date of birth into your calendar. So, you know, on the August 17th, you're going to send them a happy birthday message with no strings attached. It's just, hi, how are you? Happy birthday. Hope you're enjoying the car. And then 1 year after the sale of that car, an anniversary message that says, just checking in, 1 year since we made the sale. How are you doing? How's the car? Whatever. And I mean, those three things, to me, if I bought a car from a salesman that did that, I wouldn't buy from another person again.
Definitely. Yeah, oh, great. Let me transition to something you touched on and that you mentioned is valuable for you to see in staff as family. So you mentioned that at first you didn't have a family, and then you know you are available to work how much, whenever, wherever, for how long they need you. What has been some of the challenges having a family now, and how do you manage that? How do you make decisions around that?
Yeah, Francois, that's it's a super tough question, because my wife is also she's a gynecologist, so she's also very, very busy, and her her work is very erratic, you know. So in the past, I mean, I couldn't go to Joburg without someone being at our house on like to cover in case she gets called out. So that made the logistics side of things super tricky. We now have a live-in, so that sorts that side out. But it's tough. I mean, you know, if it's as Murphy's Law would have it, it's the weeks that I'm in Joburg that my wife gets called out two or three nights in a week. And it's, you can see on those weeks the impact that it has on the kids. And it's, that's life. Hey, you've got to make your bed, you must lie in it, and you must try and play your cards as best as you can when you do play those cards. We've taken the stance that we are grafting hard to build foundations so that we can retire earlier, or, you know, like semi-retire earlier, and spend quality time with our kids when they're in late primary school and high school. But with that means that we are going to feel guilty at times when I'm in Joburg and my wife gets called out and the kids are and acting up. It's just one of those things, I think. And also, you know, you can justify things whichever way you like. I know friends, I live in Paarl. I know friends that live here and work in Cape Town, and they're leaving at 5 o'clock in the morning and they're getting home at 7:30 at night. So even though they're not traveling to Joburg, they're not seeing the kids in the morning, and then they see their kids for like maybe half an hour before they go to bed. And it's like that tired, irritable, nightmare time. So it's not even quality time then. So that's how I justify the travel to Joburg in my head. And my wife and I are super conscientious in terms of when we are here, we present, you know. It's not, so I could be working half as hard and I could be at home twice as much, but if I'm not present when I'm here, then there's no good in that anyway. In fact, it's even worse, because then you're there and showing your kids that there's other things that are more important than them. Yeah. So I think that's our main philosophy in life is when we're home, we do a lot of stuff on the weekends, and when we're here, we're completely present. There's no phones and stuff above the kids when we're with them.
That's awesome. I agree. It's so easy, and you see and hear it often that parents are so busy with a phone, for example, that they don't even notice. They're so occupied. It's not that they are bad people or bad parents necessarily. They don't realize that the kids right there looking at them, trying to talk to them, and they're not present. So I wanted to ask you, and you mentioned it. So one of the ways you make sure that you are present, you put the phone away. When you are with the kids, there's no phone around.
Correct. So my wife, obviously, being a gynae, she needs a phone around, so in case she gets called. But it's not where we are. You know, it's like it's on the dining room table when we're away, so she can hear it, but it's not like right there with us.
Awesome. It's so simple and effective at the same time. What are some of the principles that you hope you teach your kids, either by example or maybe something that you really want to build into their lives?
So we stay in an estate where there is quite a lot of privilege. And with that, I see quite a lot of entitlement with the slightly older kids, which is probably, I think, going to be one of our biggest struggles to keep our kids grounded. That's my goal. I just want our kids to be grounded and being pleasant to be around, that they're socially accepted. I think those are the two main goals. You know, the rest is just they must make the choices that they want to they make. But if we, you know, if we've given them an environment where they feel safe and they feel like they know who they are, then I would, and they're grounded, I hope that they're going to make the right choices.
I love that. I don't know if you've read Jordan Peterson's book, 12 Rules for Life.
No, I've got it. I actually downloaded it on audiobook a couple of nights ago, but I haven't started it.
Well, one of the principles in the book that I really love, and it's something that my wife and I worked on even before reading the book, is just making sure you raise kids. I think he puts it this way, that make sure that your kids don't become someone that you dislike, that you don't like.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. So that socially accepted term actually comes from a Jordan Peterson clip. It's not.
That's exactly what I thought about. Yes. Okay. Okay. Yeah. That whole thing. So teaching your kids, even though sometimes, you know, it's hard to say no, you know, look at the person talking to you, answer back, say this, you know, you're kind of coaching and guiding them and how to interact at the beginning. Mm. But I can see with my oldest son, he's now learned that and he's doing it on his own, whereas the four-year-old still has to learn how to do that. But one of the things that happens is adults enjoy them.
Yeah.
So when they are, you know, at a coaching session with tennis or soccer or whatever it is, because they are engaged and pay attention and are respectful, aren't afraid to ask questions or whatever, the adults and the coaches enjoy them more and thus spend time with them, give them the attention that they're asking, you know, go that extra mile for them. And which, of course, if you compound that, it makes a massive difference. So I was picking up on that principle as well for you.
Yeah. So, and then obviously this, you know, following from what we've just discussed before with the travel, this makes the struggle even more, right? Yes. So, I mean, I've had many, many times where I've been in Joburg from Monday, got home Thursday, walked through the door at like 5:36 on a Thursday evening, and it's mayhem. And I catch one of the kids screaming at my wife or being rude or being a brat. And, where I have to discipline them straight off the bat. And it's something that you don't want to do as a parent. But then at the same time, you know, if I don't do this now, then I'm just kicking the can down the road to let this just become worse and worse. So that's one of the struggles, you know, and my wife, you know, when you, I think, I don't know, most women have this mom guilt and it's a real thing, especially when you're a hardworking mom. And so that's one of our struggles as parents, Candace and I. She has mom guilt, she works hard, and then if she's seeing the kids, she doesn't want to discipline the kids in that time, you know. So these are the obstacles that we have to overcome. But it's not easy, you know. But I think it's like you have to sometimes do the unpleasant things now because you realize that long term it's going to be better for everyone.
Yeah. Are there any parenting books that you've read or principles that you've picked up? You mentioned Jordan Peterson already, but anything that you recommend people look at or read?
To be honest, I haven't. I think I've just picked up a few things by people that I follow on YouTube or whatever. And one of them was this Jordan. But I think in a time where kids and our kids as well, it's difficult to overcome this, but kids are so used to instant gratification that it can almost, you know, when you don't get what you want immediately, you become bratty about it. Those are the principles that I'm just looking at it, our own kids. And also I understand our two are very, very, very different. So, a parenting style for number one and a parenting style for number two have to be completely different because they respond differently. So we just look at our two kids case in point and how are they doing? How are they being accepted by our friends? How are they being accepted by their friends? And are they 90%+ of the time being just decent human beings? You know, like you're going to have these outbursts, they're tired, they're hungry, whatever. But if 95% of the time, they're being decent kids and they're not being entitled and they're being grounded, then I think that's our North Star.
I love that. What are some of the things that you still hold on to, principle-wise, guiding, you know, star-wise, in your life that you learn from childhood, either from your parents directly or maybe just going through hard times, working through a difficult situation, going to a new school, anything like that, that you feel like, you know what, I learned something there that I still use today?
So I think a couple of the, like, my own, I don't know, mission statements or stuff that I have in my own head is, there's one by Winston Churchill that says, success is not final and failure is not fatal. It's the courage to continue that counts. Opportunities don't happen, you create them. Those are two fundamental things that I believe in. You know, you haven't failed. So winners are just, winners are just losers that have tried one more time, you know, like, you know, you fail, but then, you win on the 10th time. So I'm a strong believer in that, to be honest. My dad was a hard worker. So I think, that resonates well with me, whether that's a good thing or bad thing, to be seen.
depends. Yeah.
I believe that there's nothing that cannot be achieved if you work hard enough at it and have the right support structure, and understand your own weaknesses. You know, there's things that I just can't do, but if you've got the right people in your corner, whether it be from a relationship point of view or a work point of view or a friend point of view, you can draw on these sources where you lack to help in those areas where you just maybe don't perform as well as others.
Now let's talk a little bit about personal growth and personal development. I know it's something that you value because that's kind of how I met you through 0.2. Just tell us a little bit about that journey. Why did you decide to put in the effort, the money, the time in terms of your personal development? Was it a moment or just a realization, or has it always been there?
No, I think it was a moment. I think it was clearly defined. It was in COVID, in lockdown. You know, I'd invested just over a decade of my time and my effort and, you know, into this business. And in the space of a couple of months, saw that flash before my eyes.
You mean before you joined this company?
In that time, I still remember it quite clearly. We saw what was happening in China in January 2020. We were closely watching it. We saw some of the manufacturers already pull back in terms of, you know, like, there was edge with the manufacturers. And Marcel and I looked at each other. We said, if we have a lockdown like China is in South Africa, we are in deep shit. So we have a massive expense structure. We a very capital, heavy business. Our motor cars cost a lot. They're on a bank floor plan. That bank floor plan is expensive with interest. So our cost structure is super high. And in the space of about 2.5 weeks at the beginning of February, we liquidated, I think, 70% of our stock. This was before any announcement of lockdown, and we cut our costs by almost 50%. I think it was 45%. Mm-hmm. And then we went into lockdown, and we had a still extremely high cost base and zero revenue for 2 months. And you know, I still remember it. It actually sent me down a very, very negative, dark health spiral. I was working until 2-3 in the morning, drinking wine every night, trying to come up with business ideas on how are we going to cut this, what are we going to do this as soon as we open the country opens up, how are we going to get back on track, and then waking up at going to bed at 2-3 and waking up at 5 because my mind's racing. So I was getting like 2-3 hours of sleep. I was drinking wine every night. I think I put on 10-15 kgs from the fittest I'd been in March, in Feb 2020, to the unhealthiest I'd been in a long time, 6 months later. So even when we came out, it wasn't, you know, like we went through the woodwork. So we came out of lockdown. We had minimal runway left, and I was still working hard and stressed and drinking probably a bottle of wine every night. So, and you know, it's, we, my wife and I got a very, very open relationship, and I'm not, I've never been averse to being vulnerable to anyone, especially my wife, but you're acutely aware that in this highly stressful situation, there is also, you don't need to burden your wife with everything, you know? So I'm seeing the runway, and if they hadn't opened the lockdown in at that time, if it had been another month, I don't know if our business would have made it. I think most businesses wouldn't have made it, right? A lot of businesses didn't, even with that shorter time span. And I'm thinking we might be out of this house and in a one bedroom flat in 6 months' time. Mm-hmm. And I've got, the only person I'm talking to is my business partner, who's in the same boat as me. So it's not giving me fresh perspective. You know, we're both in the trenches and we're both stressed. I can't talk to my wife properly, and I can allude to a couple of things, but I didn't want to stress her out as much as I was stressed. And I was just like, I've got no one to talk to. I've got no one to bounce ideas off. And even from a commercial point of view, from business plan point of view, my business partner and I are working together 24/7. We think the same. A lot of the time we think the same. So we're not bringing like this fresh perspective. So yeah, it ended up we did well. We didn't retrench. We closed one of our facilities down and merged it into another facility. So out of 350 people, we only lost 15 people, and that was just probably we were weak in terms of our business decision making prior to COVID, and we were holding on to something from a you know, what's the right word? We felt attached to it.
And okay, sentimental almost about it.
Correct. Okay. We should have made the decision a year or two before that. We hadn't, and COVID forced our hand, and we closed that. We merged the two, so we only had one workshop. So we lost some of the workshop staff. But and this was in a time where the industry, the motor industry, were retrenching 60% of staff, and we did 15 out of 350, I think it was. So I think we came out of that with feeling like we'd had a major success. We kept our business open. Staff came behind us. We were all on 50% pay cuts. And as difficult as that was, everyone was stood together. We made it through and had minimal casualties. But you know, I distinctly remember being in that situation going, yes, it would be nice to be bouncing some thoughts off, different people, different perspectives, get input. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of my mates are CAs. A lot of my mates are like fund managers. So they make money whether the market's up or down, and they can make money from home. So they had a very, very, very different reality to me during COVID. They didn't go into pay cuts. They didn't have, they weren't seeing like potential job loss in a few months' time. So I couldn't communicate with my best mates because they just didn't understand. And then, 2.0 came around, and they had good quality mates from different avenues in life. And it was really incredible to just hear different perspectives on everything, business.
How did you discover that, Justin?
One of the guys was on Pearl Valley Estate and invited me into it. And so it was through the community here in Pearl Valley. But yeah, I haven't looked back. It's a good bunch of guys, and you know, the growth has not only been from like a strategic point of view. There's a lot of strategic benefit that we get from the group, but also from a personal and family point of view. It's good to hear. We all go through the same struggles. We all have the same issues. We've got kids that are not listening to us, and just like we've spoken about before, but we're all actually in the same boat, and it's not, you're not the anomaly.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I visited you guys, we spoke about boundaries. So could you maybe talk about how you've started implementing some of those principles, and what's been hard in terms of boundaries, and what's been really fruitful for you?
Yeah, so I think for your listeners, I don't know if you've mentioned this previously on your podcast, so you put it quite eloquently. To set a boundary, you've got to consciously disappoint someone.
Yeah,
right. And if you don't set that boundary, you are either consciously disappointing yourself, or you are consciously disappointing a family member that is being impacted by this boundary that you're not setting at work, or whatever the case is,
or unconsciously disappointing them.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. So so that resonated with me, and every time I feel like I'm on this 50-50, is this really, really important? And do I need to attend to this immediately? Or if it's after work hours, and this is I think probably one of the greatest challenges for an entrepreneur, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Don't have an 8 to 5. Yeah. It's awesome, because when things are going well and your business is going well, you've got the flexibility to start a little bit later. You've got the flexibility to end a little bit earlier on a day. You govern your entire diary, which is amazing. In the bad times, that doesn't stop. You know, you're working from 4 o'clock. You're working until 12, 1 in the morning. That's just how it is. But even in the normal times, your mind doesn't stop. That's just how most entrepreneurs are. Your mind doesn't stop. So you're constantly thinking about the business. How can I improve this? Did I do that? Did I delegated this to so-and-so, but they haven't got back to me. I wonder if it's been done. This is the nature of the beast. But now I'm being very more conscious on when I'm with my kids, and this comes back to our discussion before, this is time for family time. And unless there is a massive disaster, they take precedent over all of that stuff. So, you know, I'm consciously not disappointing my kids when I'm with them, or trying at least. I mean, I still fail. I'm not, you know, I'll also sometimes find, oh, I didn't take my phone out and leave it on the dining room table. It's in my pocket. And then before I know it, it's in my hand. So yeah, that happens.
Sure.
But you know, I think it really did resonate with me, and I can't say I'm committing to working slightly harder now to build the life that I can be at my kids' games on a Wednesday afternoon in 10 years time, when I want to be. But with that, understand that when I am home, I must be home and I must be there, and then not stick to that. So, yeah, I think it, and then with that mindset, I think one of my big issues was a lot of the stuff that you fear in terms of setting that boundary is your own impression of what the other person might be wanting or requiring or expecting. You know, so you often will build things up in your own head, like, oh, they've asked for it here at 10 o'clock or 8 o'clock at night, and they expect me. But actually, it's just they've offloaded their thought now while they thought of it, and are quite comfortable with me only getting back to them on a Monday morning, 8 o'clock, you know. I build that up in my head going, I can't, why would they message me now? You know, so I think that's quite a key lesson that I think a lot of people do is maybe the issue isn't as big as you've built it up into your head.
Definitely. We make up a story as to why this person is asking me now or asking this. And especially powerful is the story we make up that if we say no, this will happen, they will think this, or this will happen to my career or whatever. And 90% or more of that even is just, it's not true. It's not going to happen. And the rest you can talk about. Thank you for sharing that so openly and honestly, especially about your kids as well. That's powerful. What do you think stops people from taking action in terms of putting themselves in a position where they can get challenged and grow? So let me phrase it another way. Maybe that'll help you just think about your answer. I mean, why you went through this crisis where you realized, okay, shit, I have to do something now. Something has to change. I realize I've got a need, and I look around, I can't address that need in my current situation. So what? Why didn't you think about that sooner?
Yeah, I think until you get into stressed situations, you don't realize where the cracks are your armor, right? And I think also if there was one good thing that came from COVID and lockdown is that this whole dogmatic view of fragile minds and, asking for help in terms of anxiety medication and stuff like that. As I remember it, pre-COVID, people didn't speak about it. It was taboo, and now post-COVID, people are open. People offer it up in conversation, in social standings all the time now. I don't remember that happening. I'm an anxiety meds. Of course, I wouldn't survive without it. You hear that all the time. Mm-hmm. So, for me, that is also one step closer to people going, okay, geez, I can't do this by myself. Mm-hmm. So whether that means, okay, I need anxiety meds or I need someone to speak to that has a different perspective and can bounce ideas off and maybe start peeling off the layers that I don't even know I've got on. I would assume that someone like you would be easier to acquire or work with people now, because I think people are a little bit more open to it, post that. But yeah, for me, I mean, I went through, I thought I was hunky-dory, perfect, I was clear sailing, and I was coping. I'd never anxious. I mean, I've always been in a stressful job. I have been stressed, but I've never felt like I couldn't deal with that stress. COVID was just this next level. And I think for me, I've managed my stress because it's my stress on me. And then in the last 6-7 years, it's my stress on me and maybe stress on what could happen to my family, but still quite contained. COVID was a different stress for me. It was like a stress on steroids. We had 350 people, and some of those people were supporting 3-4 people in their family. Mm-hmm. I was acutely aware that even though our hands were tied because the government was doing this and the government wasn't taking action here, people were looking to Marcel and I to lead this business and keep us afloat. And if we didn't, there were a lot of families that were going to be affected. And that was something that I was never prepared for. So I felt anxiety like I'd never felt before.
Mm. Yeah, I think a lot of people can identify with that feeling, the amplification of things that might have been there in the past, but now suddenly it's really focused. Justin, there's a lot of stuff that I still want to ask you, but our time has run out. Thank you very much for setting aside the time to talk to me and the listeners. You've definitely shared some very powerful stuff and brought some fresh perspective that I think will help other people as well. So thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you. And thanks for having me.
No, you're welcome. See you next time.
Yeah. Cheers, Francois.
Bye.